ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The outdoors. Nothing quite like it. Fresh air, clear waters, rich soil, the freshest ingredients within grasp. Abundant picks, a tweak from a bush, grub from the ground, plucked from the ocean waves. It's no wonder that some of the world's top chefs are trading in their chef whites for overalls, embracing homegrown or hyper-local produce and ditching the grand banquet halls in favour of intimate dining rooms. It must bring an immense sense of calm and purpose to the job. You'd never look back, would you?
I do miss it. There are times, especially when I watch the TV show The Bear, which doesn't really feel altogether healthy, that I watch that and I'm like, oh, I missed this. And everyone else is like, I'm so traumatised by the show.
Make sandwiches! Don't stop making sandwiches!
Yes, sir.
I'm going to make three sections, okay?
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science, and history collide. This week, Annalise Gregory, Wild Chef.
As we descend to about 6 metres, I can feel the swell pushing me around. I make my way through the thick kelp and start searching for craze. That means sticking my hand into crevices. I find a cray, but it wriggles free and gets away. Then I'm suddenly hit with a sense of panic. I have to surface. Now.
After years working at some of the world's top restaurants, Annalise Gregory now experiences more pressure diving for seafood and she does in the kitchen. She's worked at Michelin-starred restaurants, the Ledbury in England, Muguritz in Spain, and with Michel Bras in France. Here in Australia, well, she's worked at Key and Franklin. Originally from New Zealand, Annalise now calls the Huon Valley home, southern Tasmania, where she draws culinary inspiration from the surrounding land and sea and all that it provides. Her adventures are documented in the SBS television series Girl's Guide to Hunting, Fishing and Wild Cooking. And in it, we see Annalise diving for crayfish, hunting for wallaby, foraging for seaweeds and native herbs. She's also written a book about her life in Tasmania, How Wild Things Are. So, of all the places in the world where one could fish, hunt and gather, why has Annalise settled in this place? What is it about the colder climate, the temperateness of southern Tasmania that appeals to the adventurer within?
I love the produce and the sweetness of the seafood in the temperate climate. I don't actually like the temperate climate for myself personally. I'm not really a cold weather person, which makes living here a strange decision.
Well, and I'm intrigued too. You have such a fine pedigree of classic restaurant work. I mean, tell us a bit about that history, about that journey.
So I started in kitchens when I was about 15. And since then, I was working all over the world. I left New Zealand when I was 17 or 18 to move to the UK and just fell into the world of Michelin restaurants and worked in like London, Paris, San Sebastian, Morocco, Sydney, many places. And then, I don't know, I guess I got to a stage where I just wanted to, you know, to see the produce, to know where it was from, to be able to visit farms, to be outdoors and to not just be, you know, kind of like locked in a box staring at the wall all day.
And yet it was in that journey that you describe, in particular your time with Michel Bras, the idea of foraging, that little light went off then. I think I've heard you say that you used to think it was something that was restricted to hippies and apprentices from Noma, but you discovered the possibilities.
I did. I was one of those people. I thought that, you know, they were just out there foraging sea buckthorn and taking photos. And then I worked at a restaurant in countryside France where, you know, foraging is a really important part of the menu. And they put me in charge of the foraging team and I fell in love with it. I realized that, you know, like it was a free Michelin star restaurant, high stress, and that was the antidote to my working hours in the afternoons when I'd go out, put headphones on and just like wander through the woods picking wood sorrel and, you know, tiny flowers and things like that.
That conjunction of woodland produce and a three-star Michelin restaurant, how those things come together, I'm sort of intrigued by that because I think that it strikes me that's a bit of a hallmark of your work is bringing the raw ingredient into a state of some sort of culinary fineness.
Increasingly, I find I'm trying to not do too much to the raw ingredient, but just have the raw ingredient be the best it can possibly be. Mm. And then, yeah, try not to mess with it too much, I think is the road now.
Was that the experience that you had in France?
The experience that I had in France, like they're very interesting at Bras. Like they go out in the nature and pick all of these things. And, you know, Michelle's credited for bringing a lot of, you know, the micro herbs and like the herbs and flowers to the plates, you know, whether you love or hate that. But it makes sense there because, you know, they're not buying them in little punnets or things like that and getting them sent from the veg supplier. They're just like, we go out into nature around the restaurant, we pick what's there, we serve it on the plates. If it's not there, we don't serve it. So in that instance, it made so much sense to me.
You were very keen to work there, weren't you?
Oh, yes, it was my Holy Grail restaurant. I was stalking him since I was 18 years old.
How did you do that?
So in the pre-digital age, I would write letters every year. I would write a letter requesting a job.
What would you say? What was your pitch?
Just that I was a young chef and I really wanted to work there. And if they ever had a job that they could get in touch with me and let me know, and basically I would drop everything and go.
And he was that to you because...
I walked into a bookshop in London when I was about 17 and bought his book and read it, Michel Bras Essential Cuisine, and did not understand it at all. And then wanted to understand it, like wanted to know what it was all about, you know. It's very poetic. It's very a lot about the play between like light and shade, and there's lots of artsy pictures at the back of just like the landscape around Aubrac and the plateau and things like that. And I was like, how does this belong in a cookbook? What are these doing here? It confused me.
How important is that French tradition of that particular set of skills and tastes?
I mean, in the kitchen that I was brought up in and the training that I had, which was City and Guilds in New Zealand, it underpins everything. So much of what we were learning all the time, you know, is like the French mother sauces, you know, it's all going back to Escoffier, really, and Le Repertoire and things like that. So it was the underpinning of kind of everything I had learned.
Escoffier, for the uninitiated, is the French chef and author of Le Guide Culinaire, published in 1903. Then came Le Repertoire de la Cuisine, written by followers of Escoffier. And later we get La Russe Gastronomique, another tome of traditional French flavours and techniques. They're all vital documents and seen as foundational to our modern understanding of French cuisine. So it's fascinating to hear that a grounding in such a formalised and specific culinary art could also be the basis for adventurous experimentation. Food using ingredients Escoffier would never have heard of.
I think it's this thing that, you know, you can go your own way and you can break the rules, but it's really much more ideal to know what they are first before you try to change them.
Yes, that's not a bad rule for life.
Yeah.
I mean, there are downsides, of course, about the big professional kitchen. I mean, tell me about that experience broadly.
So for me, I kind of loved the militaristic aspect of it. I suppose something about my personality, you know, I just fell into it and it was all encompassing. You know, you work in a kitchen, it's you know, back in those days, it was, you know, 16-hour days. And so you don't really need to do much else in the rest of your life. You just, like, you go to work, you go home, you have a set of friends already from work, you know, you drink with them or hang out with them outside of work. So it kind of, you can move anywhere in the world and feel, I don't know, enveloped by it, I suppose. Like, it is, you know, like a community or family. So it gave me the ability to move to multiple different countries and feel comfortable. But I guess I thrived on it for so long. And then there was a, I don't know when the turning point was, but there was a turning point where I know it kind of started to work against me, I suppose. You know, I was just constantly tired. The hours were a lot. The stress was a lot. I was maybe not dealing with it as well as I had in the past. And I started to want something else.
I mean, as you say, it is this key to sort of a global culture. That's a lot to give up in a way.
I do miss it. There are times, especially when I watch the TV show The Bear, which doesn't really feel altogether healthy, that I watch that and I'm like, oh, I miss this. And everyone else is like, I'm so traumatized by the show.
I want to be back in that. I mean, it's interesting. In a kitchen where those stresses occur, and I suspect they're almost inevitable, given the pressures of the restaurant as a business, is that the best environment to produce good food? Does that get in the way, perhaps, of, you know, the food being as wonderful as it might be?
It's really hard to say, and it's something that I think about all the time, that, you know, is like, food produced with love tastes better, and I think it does, but something about for the finesse of those restaurants, you need a relatively strict environment to be able to have things be that consistent and that tight and that similar.
Repeatability is the big issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. You know, basically to become really, really good at something, what is it, you need to spend 10,000 hours doing it? It is the repetition that makes you really good at something.
Take me to your Tasmanian home. Describe this place.
So a 110-year-old weatherboard cottage in the Huon Valley, which is Australia's southernmost municipal area, so very far south, and an old garden that used to be 60 years of blackberries covering many sheds and buildings until I got goats who are slowly eating all of those off.
Go goats.
And I'm slowly trying to basically leave things better than I found them. So, you know, replace weatherboards and pour concrete slabs and rework the garden. And I have goats, I have chickens, sometimes there's sheep. I have a small fluffy truffle dog called Kina. And I have a little shed that has been turned into a commercial kitchen.
Was the intent initially to make food from this place, to explore the terroir of the place that you had arrived in?
I think so. I mean, I was running a restaurant called Franklin in Hobart for the first 3 years after I moved down. And then the pandemic happened. And I realised that there was a possibility that I didn't need to drive for an hour and a half to get to work every day. And that I could spend that time on doing other things, like perhaps sleeping or perhaps, you know, like working on my food more or something like that. And also just being better at running a country house and looking after my animals and looking after the garden and being present.
And yet now there is a professional kitchen in that.
Yes, there is.
in that world.
The intention was to create just a really nice home office so that I could, you know, write cookbooks and test recipes and do things like that without it being in my house, because I'm not very good at the breakdown between from working from home. Mm. And then I don't know when it occurred to me, but I was like, oh, I guess I could open it to the public and do some lunches and they could come and eat all of the things that I'm making. I think I had too much food and I was having to give it away to lots of people because I just have this drive to, you know, to preserve and to make things.
Too much food. That's it's okay. There's only one thing to do with that, as you say. This takes me to the diving as part of your process. I mean, talk to me about that. I mean, you were a recreational diver, I think, before you put it to more constructive purpose.
Well, when I moved to Tassie and there was a sous chef at the restaurant I was working at, Franklin, and he was like, you know, have you ever been diving for sea urchin or abalone before? I was like, no. I was like, I've never been diving anywhere that's less than 20 degrees Celsius. And on a really like windy, sleety, gross day in winter, he took me for a dive down at Fossil Cove and, you know, we sat on the beach and ate sea urchins off a dive knife and they were the best that I had had outside of Japan. And that sold me. That sold me on it. So several very thick wetsuits, hood, gloves, booties. So really everything possible to keep the cold water at bay. And I am in the ocean hunting for food.
So take me on a dive. What do we see?
There's so many seaweed species and you start to realize that the things that you're looking for in terms of abalone or sea urchins, like they have a terrain that they like under the ocean. So, you know, where there's like big rocky boulders and there's lots of crevices, there's lots of seaweed because that's their main food source. And also conveniently where the water's quite rough and quite choppy. So like, you know, where like the surf hits the rocks is where they like to be.
Oh, good.
I know, exactly. Because yeah, those are really safe, great places to dive. But that is where you'll find them. And so then once you start being able to, you know, spot something underwater and harvest it and then like harvest your own seafood, it's just, I don't know, it's a thrill, I suppose. It's addictive.
But it's also a process of acquiring knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah, I love to learn. I need to always be doing something new or learning something new, otherwise I'm not really happy.
Mm. So how do you go about that in a situation like that? Is it just experience? Is it pulling things out and showing them to people, saying, what is that? Where do you turn for information?
I suppose in the beginning I had found people that dived already and got them to take me on dives with them for quite a bit until I felt comfortable, you know? And then a combination of the Taz Seafood app and things like that, like government-based information, and then also just learning off people in the ocean.
And I guess seaweeds are a bit like mushrooms. I mean, once you know what that looks like, you know what that looks like.
Yes and no. Yes, once you know what it looks like, but no seaweed is going to kill you if you put it in a beef Wellington or eat the wrong one. Every seaweed is technically edible. Some are less delicious, but they're all technically edible.
And some shouldn't be there. Wakame is one of your favourites.
Wakame should not be there, and it is one of the more delicious ones. So those two things go nicely hand in hand with each other for me.
How did you make that discovery?
I think I was just looking at the seaweed in the ocean and I was trying to put names to all of them. And then I was like, oh my God, it's wakame, because it's quite a distinctive seaweed. You know, it has like long stipes. It has this fruiting body called mekabu at the base, which is like a big jumble of seaweeds that where it attaches to the seafloor. And then I was like, wow, the same wakame that's in Japan, you know, that we buy dried in all of the supermarkets and things. Why am I using dried Japanese seaweed when I could be using fresh Tasmanian seaweed?
It's such an interesting twist to have, you know, the chef of your experience, the person with your depth of knowledge, there you are under the water and emerging with a handful of ingredient. It's kind of an exciting way to go about your business.
I mean, it beats the hell out of being in a basement kitchen all the time, you know, just like me in the past, you know, chef whites, like bright lights, white basement kitchen, lots of stainless steel, you know, doing my job very efficiently. Or me now just like, you know, putting a wetsuit on, jumping into the ocean.
And that idea of the foraging and I guess also of the sort of paddock to plate ethos, I mean, how much does that force a certain ingenuity? How much does it make you sort of rifle through the index card in your mind?
It's actually been great. When I first moved to Tasmania, I found it a little bit hard because you can't choose what you want to work with here. You know, there's no Excel spreadsheet printout from the market, you know, for you to be like, oh, we want asparagus. It is just like everything is micro-seasonal and, you know, it's in or it's not. And then you have to wait a whole nother year for it, which does give you time to come up with what you want to do the next year. You're like, oh, celeriacs are out. Okay, that dish will have to wait till next year. We'll have to sideline that. But in some ways it's enforced creativity, but I think that can be a good thing.
So water is important. How important is fire?
Very important. So Franklin was the first restaurant I'd worked at that was primarily fire-based. You know, there was a 2-ton wood-fired Scotch oven, which was the main thing we cooked with there. And I had never worked from a wood-fired oven for service before. You know, previously I was always very like, you know, steam ovens, induction, things that are small and very like refined. And it was a really big learning curve for me. In the beginning, I didn't love it. It was a lot harder to work with, you know, plus like the constant feeding of the fire during service, keeping those things up. Then I fell in love with it. And now food doesn't taste the same to me if it's not cooked with some element of fire.
From ABC Radio National, you're listening to Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green, and today you're meeting Annalise Gregory, New Zealander by birth. She trained with some of the best chefs in Europe and now lives in southern Tasmania, where she hunts, forages, and farms her own produce.
Do you feel really in touch with the place? Do you feel a sense of belonging in that country now?
I do, but it's not hard for me to feel a sense of belonging in different places. I feel like everywhere that I've lived, I've fallen in love with in its own way. I think that's just what I do. I'm a bit of a chameleon. So that's what happens when I move to a different place. You know, when I was living in Morocco, I fell in love with Morocco and I was like, I could stay here forever. now I feel the same way about Tasmania.
But there's a difference surely in when you were trying to sustain yourself from that place as well. If that place is feeding you, if and being in touch with the rhythms of place is important into, you know, how that place is going to feed you and how well.
Oh, yeah, my happiest moments are just, you know, being in the forest and just being still and kind of being one with it, or, you know, being in the ocean or on a deserted beach. Basically just being out in nature and feeling like you're part of it.
And you are someone who has put together two wonderful words that have, I think, for me, opened a world of possibilities, and they are possum sausages.
yes, I'm going to say it's not the best recipe in the book. But, you know, I was at a point of, like, pushing boundaries and trying new things.
Well, and that's, again, coming back to that notion of skill. To push the boundary, you have to have the base.
Yeah, I guess it's something. When I was a young chef, I had lots of ideas and I couldn't execute them. You know, I was like, I want to set all these things inside a jelly that's see-through and, you know, then you'll be able to eat it and they'll be, you know, suspended in there. But I couldn't execute the things because I didn't have the base knowledge yet. And I found that really frustrating. And so then, you know, I went to and worked in a lot of really good restaurants to learn the skills. And I remember my father's also a chef. I remember once when I was a young AG, he took me to the Fat Duck and we were talking about Heston Blumenfeld's food. And he said to me, you know, he was like, you have to learn the skills to be able to, you know, exactly that, to be able to break the rules. You know, he was like, Heston can make everything perfectly the traditional way. And then now he is, you know, turning it on its head. But like he has the skill to be able to back it up. So everything is still delicious. And I guess that really stuck with me.
I think that's such an interesting thing because it's then I'd like to sort of, I'm intrigued by then the connection between something of that refined experimentalism, like a Blumenthal, and the abalone plucked fresh from the ocean and treated simply. The line between those two things is interesting.
It doesn't feel like they're initially connected at all. But so the first time I dived for an abalone and cooked it at home, I absolutely destroyed it. You know, I just like cut it, probably too thick, put it in a pan. It was like rubber. It was horrible. I was like, is this really what everyone is talking about? Is this what this is? And then I was like, no, I have mistreated this and I need to do better. I was like, A, no one can ever know about this. And B, I need to up my game. So then, you know, I did research and testing and was like, okay, you know, like if I steam them first, if I do this, or if I freeze it and slice it on a meat slicer super fine, you know, I need to be able to cook this in a way that's delicious. And, you know, you just set your mind to something. And then now I'm able to cast an abalone on a beach and just like cook it on a tiny fire or on a camp stove or something and make something delicious. But in the beginning, I wasn't.
I'm not sure where you are with establishing your new place. You're up and running yet, or is it still in development?
It is in development. I am waiting on car park approval and then I will be up and running.
But your new place is only 10 seats, is that right?
Yes, I figured that's the amount of people that I can, you know, cook for myself comfortably. Also, it's a small shed that's been retrofitted at my house and that's how many people it seats.
And you describe it as an anti-restaurant. Explain that to me.
I didn't mean it in terms of being anything against a restaurant or anything negative against restaurants. I meant it in terms of moderating people's expectations and that, you know, it's not a place where you can just like walk into and order a la carte or, you know, just turn up. Like none of those things will be possible. Like, you know, it will be set menu. I'll just be serving, you know, what's in season and what's around what I have. It will only be open a couple of days a week. It won't be open if I'm not there. So if I'm filming a TV show or writing a book, like I will close it. So it just won't be operating in the sense of how a normal restaurant would operate.
There's quite a few chefs taking that path, aren't there? I mean, there's a, this is what I can do. This is what I can sustain psychologically. This is what I can sustain with the produce that's available to me. And it's a much simpler thing than that big, grander a la carte experience.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I've cooked in and run restaurants with the big grand a la carte experience. And then now I want to do something that fits with my lifestyle, that's closer to home for me, and that kind of pulls all the things together. You know, it's like I keep bees and I'll be able to use that honey in the restaurant. You know, I keep chickens and I'll be able to use their eggs. You know, I want to be able to just like use all of the produce that's around me and to be able to spend time, you know, with the animals and in the garden and growing things and then to put them through the restaurant, but not to be constantly like, how am I going to get produce for 60 people every night?
Yes. Work harder, bees. Come on.
Yeah, I'd need a lot of bees.
And I get, for people who come then and eat with you to have an awareness of that or who read your book and see the wildness in that, this sort of closes the gap that we've created, doesn't it, between our food and our life. It brings those things together.
Yeah, and I understand, you know, that can be a really hard thing to do, especially in cities. Like I lived in Sydney for 12 years on and off, and I struggled with it that, you know, the farms I wanted to visit were so far away. And, you know, that's part of why I've chosen to live where I am now, that, that all of those things are really close to me.
What's good in the garden at the moment?
Oh, herbs are booming. Broad beans have finally hit properly. I know we're really late this year in Tasmania. Tomatoes have just started, and I live conveniently up the road from many, many stone fruit and cherry orchards, and that is my main source of food at the moment.
So what does that put on the plate?
Last night it was a peach and tomato salad with heaps of basil.
Which I think you can also find in your book.
Yeah, and a lamb rack from the last sheep that I raised, which was delicious.
It's like jazz. Years of scale give you the skill to improvise, to express something wild and free. So what happens when a chef, used to the pressure and fine skills of a Michelin kitchen, pulls out a dive knife to lever abalone from the surf bash rocks of southern Tasmania? Well, food magic, freeform from structure, a new cuisine of cultivated wildness. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guest, Annalise Gregory, her book is called How Wild Things Are. And there are two seasons of her series, A Girl's Guide to Hunting, Fishing and Wild Cooking, streaming on SBS On Demand. And once that car park is approved, you'll be able to dine in her tiny restaurant in her home in Tasmania's Huon Valley. You can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National or any time at all on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And share us round like the flesh of a freshly caught crayfish. Perhaps you have an idea for a future episode, shoot us an email. Every Bite, all one word, at abc.net.au. Every Bite at abc.net.au. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jurek. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.